Coffee Bar. Today's programming is made possible in part by Ratio Severance Reed Architects, Designers, and Planners, dedicated to distinctive projects for higher education, lifestyle, and cultural clients, on the web at www.ratioarchitects.com.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the controls this morning. On college campuses across the country, there seems to be growing concern among officials there about the mental health of students. And there are a number of studies that have been done recently and publicized recently. You talk to people on various college campuses, and they will give you anecdotal information to the same effect, that there seems to be an increase in the number of students who report emotional difficulties and who are seeking out counseling for emotional difficulties. And the question is, well, a couple of questions. First of all, why should that be the case? And the second is, how is it that colleges and universities are moving to try to meet the needs and take care of their students? We'll be talking about that subject this morning in this part of Focus 580 with Richard Cadison. He is chief of the mental health service at Harvard University Health Services. He is a board-certified psychiatrist and has specialized in campus mental health and student mental health treatment throughout his career. He is the co-author of a book that was published last year that looks at this subject. His book is titled College of the Overwhelmed, The Campus Mental Health Crisis and What to Do About It. So if you're interested in the book, you can seek it out. Jossie Bass is the publisher. Also, questions are welcome. Questions, comments are welcome. As always, we want to involve people who are listening in the program, and it's easy to do if you just call us here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Dr. Cadison, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure.
I appreciate it. Just to talk, just put some numbers on this at the beginning. I know, for example, in your book, you cite some numbers that come from a study done by the College Mental Health Association. I know the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill has some numbers. And in individual colleges, if you go to them, they'll say, yes, we have looked at this in our campus, and we can tell you that there are these kind of numbers, there's been this kind of increase. Can you talk a little bit about the numbers of students who seem to be having mental health issues now?
Sure. The numbers are actually, very frightening, and one of the motivators for writing the book. In the American College Health Association, which is a national survey that goes out to several hundred schools, one of the questions is, have you been depressed in the past year to the point where you can't function for up to 2 weeks? And about 45% of students report being depressed to the point that they can't function. 10% of students report, that they've seriously considered suicide. So, you do the math at colleges, and those are very scary numbers.
Mm-hmm. And do we believe that these numbers, that the numbers of students talking about saying that I'm so depressed I can't function, or the number of students who would say, yes, indeed, the thought of suicide has crossed my mind, that over the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years, that these numbers have increased?
Yeah, I think there's been a pretty dramatic increase. I think there are a number of reasons for that. Some data was collected at Kansas State University looking at every person who came into the counseling center over a 13-year period from 1988 to 2001, and they broke it into three large time groups to see what the patterns and changes were. And the amount of depression doubled, the amount of suicidal ideation, I believe it is, tripled, and the amount of sexual assaults that people were coming in for quadrupled. Now, it's hard to know, how much of this is a worsening problem. I think that's a significant part of it, but also there's more reporting and more awareness. And that's, I think one of the challenges is getting students to recognize problems and getting them into care. I think that's one of our biggest challenges, actually.
Mm-hmm. Well, this certainly does raise that question that we know that people, it seems there is greater awareness of problems with mental health. There seems to be a greater willingness of people to admit that they are having problems, to seek out health. I mean, in the general population, it's still a highly stigmatized and stigmatizing thing.
Very much so. Very stigmatized. And, you know, one of the other challenges and one of the reasons I think we're seeing there are two kind of big factors that have changed, at least over the last decade. One is the advent of Prozac and the newer serotonergic antidepressants, which have far fewer side effects than the older medications, although, you know, there's recent controversy about how safe some of these medications are. But we're seeing many more students. I get many calls in the summer from families saying, you know, my son or daughter is on medication. We want to make sure there's continuity of care, so we want to arrange for, you know, coverage and treatment when the student arrives at college. So that's one factor. Another factor is there's been a large increase in the number of international students. And I think it varies from school to school, but a lot of the large universities have very significant number of international students, and they face, you know, even greater stigma, particularly certain groups of Asian students. They also face, you know, larger cultural adjustments and sometimes educational adjustments to a kind of different learning style. So, you know, that's a group that I think is also particularly vulnerable in these times. And, of course, the war and terrorism and, you know, 9/11 have you know, added stress to everyone's life.
I wonder if it's possible to separate difficulties that students may have that may come on after arriving at the campus, separate that from difficulties that they may bring with them when they come to school.
Yeah. I think that one of the factors with in the antidepressant situation is that many students who never would have gotten to college are getting treated in high school and when they're younger, and they're now, you know, being successful enough academically to make it to school. So we are seeing more people coming in who, you know, have problems earlier but might never have seen the, you know, front door to the college environment. There are big changes in healthcare. So when people have more serious mental health problems, if they need to be hospitalized, for example, eating disorders are very prevalent on college campuses. 3 to 5% of college-age women have eating disorders. In the past, when I first started my career, if someone had a serious eating disorder and might have needed hospitalization, they might have been in the hospital for 2 or 3 months. Now they're in the hospital for, you know, 5 to 10 days. So we're also seeing students coming back on campus, you know, with serious problems much sooner. And I think the expectation in hospital settings is that, you know, there's supportive people in the dormitories and other places so they can, you know, send the students back more easily.
Mm-hmm. Let me, again, just real quick introduce our guest for anybody who might have tuned in the last couple of minutes. We're speaking with Dr. Richard Cattison. He's chief of the Mental Health Service at Harvard University Health Services. He's a board-certified psychiatrist and throughout his career has specialized in campus mental health and student mental health treatment. He is the co-author of a book that was published last year titled College of the Overwhelmed, The Campus Mental Health Crisis and What to Do About It. Now, questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You're talking about the fact that it may indeed be that more students now arrive on campus with some previous mental health issues, but also one wants to raise the question, well, is there something about college life today that is inherently more stressful than it was when I was in college, when you were in college, you know, 20, 30 years ago, however long that was, that also makes the problem worse?
Yes, I absolutely think there are factors related to this. And a couple of them are that we're becoming more aware of these problems, we're diagnosing them earlier. There's also more stress. Parent income has gone up about 75%. College tuition has gone up about 200% in the last 15 years. So people are feeling increasing financial pressure when they get to school. I think when people are in school, they're feeling an enormous amount of pressure to, you know, to be successful, to get a good job. These are issues that I think have intensified over the year. And another key factor, interestingly, is sleep. That if you don't get enough sleep it worsens, you know, increases the likelihood that you're going to get depressed or have bipolar disorder or trigger some underlying mental health problem. And there's some interesting research that has gone on at the University of Michigan, and it seems that the average college student is now sleeping less than 7 hours a night. And a researcher named Roseanne Armitage at the University of Michigan feels that when students get under an average of about 7 hours a night, it really impairs their functioning. They become sleep deprived. It impairs their academic functioning, and also makes them more susceptible to developing other kinds of problems. Substance abuse is still, you know, alcohol use, binge drinking. You know, 44% of students have episodic binge drinking, and there are all kinds of associated problems that go with that, you know, assault, sexual assaults, a variety of other things. So the sleep factor is I think, you know, worse than it used to be. I think a lot of college students don't sleep very much, but the sense is that the trend is that people are sleeping less and less and trying to cram more and more into their lives. And with the weekend schedule that college students live, where they're up till 4 or 5 in the morning and sleep till noon the next day and then try to get back into an academic routine on Monday, is kind of the equivalent of flying to Paris for the weekend, that their body is jet-lagged every weekend, and it takes a while to readjust, especially if you're not getting enough sleep.
Yeah. All right. We have a caller here in Indiana to talk with. Let's do that on our line number 4. Hello.
Hello. After I ask this question, I'm going to hang up so the man running the bank can know what I'm doing at least. You've already approached what I was going to ask about in a very general sense, is the binge drinking and the date rape. Is there any correlations between our mental health patients and this? It looked to me like it's, you know, we're still doing this testosterone thing, and the good old guys are, and I know from my experience years ago in college that most of the drunks had a hell of a lot of trouble getting through and basically made it by, having guys help them take tests and things like that. So I was wondering if there's any correlation going on there. I'll hop off and hang up now.
Okay. There's definitely a correlation between alcohol use and sexual assault. It seems that on most campuses, almost every situation of sexual assault involves alcohol with one or both parties. And, of course, you know, when people are drinking, it's very difficult to kind of sort out what the reality is of a situation. We've done a lot of work on alcohol education, and the results, you know, to date have been pretty disappointing, that we really have not, in the past 10 years, have not reduced the amount of binge drinking, which, again, you know, triggers depression. Alcohol is a depressant, triggers other kinds of problems. So, it continues to be a bind. I think that one place that we've gotten to is that, you know, although we can't tell students who are underage it's okay to drink, it also does not, you know, doesn't seem to make a difference to tell students not to drink. Just say no doesn't seem to work. And I think the approach is really educating students about responsible drinking. And by that, I don't mean encouraging people who are underage to break the law, but to educate the whole community about the risks of alcohol and ways to drink more responsibly.
All right. Let's talk with someone in Urbana on line number 1. Hello.
Yeah. In the percentages that you quoted, the 45%.
Uh-huh.
What's the percentage when we relate that to the general population?
Well, that's a good question. Generally the amount of depression, you know, depression is measured in a lot of different ways. Most people think the lifetime risk for depression is somewhere between 10 and 25%. What the 45% means is not that 45% of students in college are depressed and have, you know, a biologic depression or a, you know, major depression that needs intensive treatment. It means to me that there's a lot of stress in college, that some of these symptoms trigger depression. It clearly impairs people's functioning. The message I think we need to get out, and I'm kind of preaching to schools around the country, is that the emotional and physical well-being of students goes hand in hand with their academic success. When people are stressed out, and 45% of students are feeling, you know, depressed and overwhelmed by their work, they're not functioning at maximum efficiency academically either.
But there's no equivalent to, because, you know, everybody has this thing from time to time. It depends, from my understanding, how long you've been in sort of this down thing.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, you talk to most college students, and I remember back, I'm sure, you know, part of the reason I'm so interested in this and in this field is when I was in college, I was scared, you know, I was socially, you know, somewhat awkward and shy. And, you know, I drank too much on weekends. But in those days, you know, if someone said, have you thought about going to counseling, I would have kind of, you know, looked funny at them and said, you know, what are you talking about? You know, what counseling? So I think part of it is, and also students hear much better from other students. So, you know, part of the effort has to be students, you know, there are lots of student mental health advocacy groups talking about, you know, if you've got these symptoms, you should do something about it. And depression usually gets better on its own, you know, whether you're in college or outside eventually. But it's like, you know, if you have pneumonia, you'll probably recover from pneumonia, but do you want to take antibiotics and get better in 3 weeks, or do you want to, you know, drag out for 3 or 4 months? And I think in school, when people are depressed, there are steps that they can take to get out of that. And sometimes, you know, if it's persistent, as you said, if it goes on for several weeks or a couple of months, then someone gets way behind academically and they get in a vicious cycle. And, you know, sometimes students have to take time off.
Yeah, and the second part is isn't there a strong relationship between alcohol and depression?
Yeah, there is. There's a correlation between alcohol, depression, anxiety, and sleep. So, you know, if you're stressing your body by, you know, drinking a lot regularly on weekends, by not getting enough sleep, by, you know, feeling stressed out academically, all of those factors will increase the likelihood that you're going to be depressed. Also, again, there's controversy about, you know, the numbers of people on antidepressant medication, and the, you know, the pharmaceutical companies are certainly publicizing the warning signs of depression. You know, it's a double-edged sword. On the one hand, they're pushing their products. On the other hand, you know, people are becoming more aware of how common the problems are. But also, sometimes the antidepressant medications can trigger off bipolar disorder, can trigger off another type of depression that can be more serious. Students can become psychotic. So sometimes we're dealing with that students get to college, start on these medications, and then, you know, become manic, and that's the first evidence of mania is triggered by their being on the medication.
Yeah, the last one is that the efficacy of Prozac in some of these, isn't it maybe only 20% or 30% in terms of being effective or not?
Well, I would say the numbers are more like 60 or 70% of people who respond. And again, it depends on, you know, what kinds of symptoms you're treating. You know, there's some good research that milder forms of depression, if you exercise regularly, if you exercise 4 days a week, get 30 minutes of good cardiovascular exercise, that will, you know, stave off milder forms of depression. There are types of depression that are related to, you know, in our part of the country where it gets dark and dreary in the winter, there's seasonal affective disorder where people get more depressed in the winter months. Sometimes light therapy or being in rooms with bright lights can make a difference there. Sometimes medication helps with that. So it really depends on the population. But the medications, I think, are highly effective. There's a lot of controversy now, as you're probably aware, of kids under 18, whether or not these medications are safe, whether there's an increase in suicidal ideation.
Mm-hmm.
Most people who practice clinically don't think that we think that there's a vulnerability period when people first start on medications, when you have to watch them closely. But you know, we've all seen too many young students who are, you know, miserably depressed and can get barely out of bed, and then they go on medication and get some psychotherapy, and they just feel like their old selves again within a month.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. One of the things that college campuses have done to try to meet the needs of students, they've been sort of forced to increase the resources that they put into providing counseling for students. And so mental health centers like yours and those in other campuses have had to hire more counselors, have had to increase staff. How well do you think are colleges and universities doing just, you know, set aside a lot of the other questions about the deeper causes, just in an sort of immediate way responding to the crisis and providing that service for students?
I don't think we're doing a very good job yet. I think we're making progress. And there are innovative programs around the country, you know, including one at the University of Illinois with, you know, Dr. Jaffe, you know, identifying students who are at high risk for suicide and mandating them in for counseling. So there are creative things going on around the country, but by and large, I think most places are very significantly understaffed. You know, counseling services are expensive. Medication is very expensive. If you have a prescription benefit on your campus, that antidepressants are the most prescribed medications on college campuses. If you have a prescription benefit, it jacks up the student health fee or the cost to colleges by quite a bit. I think it's very short-sighted to not provide these services, because if you don't retain students, if students get depressed, don't get the treatment they need, and go home, you lose far more in tuition than you lose, you know, than you gain by, you know, helping to keep students healthy. But there, I think we're dramatically underserved. Harvard, for example, in terms of prescribing, we have 11 times the national average number of prescribing hours per student than, you know, is across the country. And our prescribers are flat out, you know, doing, you know, seeing students, evaluating them for medications. And we don't overprescribe. Our philosophy is start with therapy if students have a really severe depression, then talk about medication. So if we've got 11 times the resources and we're flat out, then the average number of resources around the country, I think, is inadequate. And you know, our numbers in terms of the number of students who are depressed and have other kinds of issues and problems, even though it's a highly competitive place, they're pretty much in line with the national numbers.
We have as our guest in this part of Focus 580, Dr. Richard Cattison. He's chief of the Mental Health Service at Harvard University Health Services. He is a board-certified psychiatrist and throughout his career has specialized in campus mental health. He is the co-author of the book College of the Overwhelmed, The Campus Mental Health Crisis and What to Do About It. It came out last year, published by Jossie Bass. Questions are certainly welcome. We have somebody hanging on here and I would invite others. Here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number to call is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois and Indiana. If it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455. And we have a caller here in Urbana. Next is line number two. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Can you tell me, I've got two questions. One is, I read in the Christian Science Monitor that college students across the country were taking Ritalin as a brain enhancer, that it helps them to sharpen their thinking before taking exams. And I was wondering if you're seeing some sort of effects around that.
The answer is we are, but it's hard to pin down and find out about it because, number one, students are using the medications illegally, and sometimes they're, you know, getting it from their friends and fellow students. And number two, there are many students who have genuine attention deficit problems who also are not using the medication appropriately, who sometimes abuse it, although they don't get the same you know, buzz effect that other students might. So there's some interesting research going on about this. I think we have to be more careful about it. There's a lot more Ritalin being produced than is prescribed, so it's hard to know, you know, kind of how it's getting out there. But a lot of students, and I think the you see it more in preparatory schools and very competitive places where students and sometimes their families are looking for any kind of edge they can find, you know, to do a little bit better academically. I don't think the research is actually very strong that it actually does enhance functioning all that much. But certainly there's a sense of well-being that goes with it, a sense of improved concentration. A lot of students take it. You know, I go back to my sleep comments earlier. It allows you to stay up and at least feel more focused later on into the evening. And, you know, that's something that students want to do. So, you know, sometimes it's caffeine. Sometimes people use Ritalin and drugs like that. So, you know, it is a problem. And, you know, students, you know, are savvy and, you know, they kind of know what to tell their primary care doctor in terms of I've got this symptom and that symptom. I think I have attention problems. I want to try some medication for that. So, you know, students are savvy about accessing the medication.
Yeah, I bet. and probably especially at Harvard. And which brings me to my second question, and that is that a while ago there was quite a lot of talk about what would cause happiness and unhappiness, you know, what are the factors involved, and they thought intelligence didn't really have an effect, but what intelligence might have an effect on is the gap between aspirations and what really the reality, you know, and that therefore perhaps very bright people with very high aspirations, if they perceive that they're not meeting those aspirations, are particularly prone to problems. And my question is, I was curious if you, I know you're not likely to criticize the universities as an institution, but I'm wondering if you think any kind of blame can be put on the university itself for failing to take people with a high potential and you know, give them something that they can live their lives with. And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay, sure. I think universities have to take some responsibility, and I think, you know, if we don't practice what we preach, if we don't try to lead some kind of balanced lives, there are certain schools in, you know, when I talk to schools, there are certain types of schools and institutions, sometimes dramatic arts programs or visual arts programs or architecture programs, where students are expected to be rehearsing late into the night or be in their studios late into the night working, that you set a tone, an unhealthy tone, that just creates additional stress for students. And the fact that students need to take some time off, that they can't be working all the time, you know, one of the things that predicts long-term happiness in life, you know, in one of these longer-term studies to look at satisfaction in life, are connections with people. And if people don't have time to be engaged in relationships and feel connected with, you know, other peers, with professors, with other people in residence, then they're not going to be as happy.
Well, you know, you talked about the various stressors that college students experience, and we know there are certain things that are not likely to change. Cost of college is certainly one of them, and perhaps the kind of pressure to succeed that students feel and may in fact have felt since they were little. There are some things that colleges certainly can do, and perhaps they fall into two broad categories. One might be to address the kinds of issues that you just talked about, that is the kind of stress that's inherent in the academic work and what's expected of students. The other side has to do with lifestyle and the opportunities that universities have to try to teach their students what is a healthy lifestyle. And we've talked about the fact that we want to tell students, look, don't drink too much. See if you can make sure that you can get an appropriate amount of sleep. Maybe it wouldn't hurt to, you know, look at your diet and say, you know, do you have a reasonably healthy diet? Are you getting a little exercise? You know, all the kinds of things that all people are counseled to do. Is that the place of the university to include that in the educational program? And is there a way that universities can actually do that where they can get students' attention and they'll take it seriously and maybe it'll have some effect?
I think there are ways. I think that some of the creative programming that goes on in some schools are things like freshman orientation programs to teach freshmen, to have a course where freshmen get credit around, it's a whole new world in terms of students being on their own. So, you know, having balanced nutrition, getting enough sleep, learning yoga, learning relaxation techniques, learning meditation, things that will help reduce stress and manage stress. I don't think you can get rid of stress in college. It's the nature of college, but learning how to manage stress and productively focus on stressful events, I think, can be done. So that's one group of things. Sometimes kind of outward bound or experiential programs around orientation, more orientation for international students so they can understand, you know, some cultural things about healthcare in the United States, about, you know, learning techniques to lead more balanced lives, help with, you know, academic, finding out what the academic resources are on campus. I think all campuses ought to have kind of a central, you know, lots of students live on the web now and communicate via computer. I think having a, you know, help at, you know, fill in the blank, your university. We have online screenings. There's a national online screening group called mentalhealthscreening.org that does a National Depression Screening Day. And students, you know, schools can sign up and students can anonymously go on in the middle of the night and find out about resources, about alcohol education, about stress management education. So there are resources that schools can, you know, point students to get some of this information. But I think it's really the sort of day-to-day lives and, you know, if there are RAs in the dorms, kind of educating the support staff in the dormitories about, you know, helping students to develop some of these skills, time management skills, and other skills can make a big difference.
All right. Let's talk with some other people who are listening. Next, I think, is someone in Champaign, and it's line number one. Hello.
Yes. Yes. Thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering, do you break down the difference between problems with undergraduates and with graduates? It seems, from my observation, for example, that binge drinking would be more a problem with undergraduates. And I'm sure undergraduates are stressed, but it seems that there's a dehumanizing level of work for graduate students, for example. So are they quite different?
Yes, it's, you know, I'm glad you raised that because I think it's a good point, and it's not a one size fits all. You know, Harvard has about 5,000 undergraduates, and you know, closer to 15,000 graduate schools, and I think graduate students have a special set of needs and a special set of stresses. Many of them are trying to start families. Many of them don't have the same support from their family of origin, or more financially autonomous. And because graduate school salaries are, tend to be low, they're under greater financial stresses and pressures. Also, there's a maturity level, so graduate students are more likely to be aware that they've got some significant, issues that they need help with. The suicide rate, you know, although low for all groups of students, is higher for graduate students because I think they're under more stress and have fewer support resources in place. So there are, you know, I think there are a different set of issues, and there are alcohol problems in certain graduate schools, but I think you're right that, they face different kinds of problems than undergraduates largely.
Yeah, and then as you're seeing this dramatic increase among students who apparently have access to healthcare, how do you think this reflects in the larger society? I mean, could it be that we also have massive problems, but we just don't have people keeping tabs on it?
Well, I think these problems are huge, and I think a lot of work has to be done to reduce the stigma, to make people more aware of these problems. And again, I think one of the key parts to the solution is having students sitting around the table. One of the things that we've done. We have, you know, what's called a coordinating board, which essentially has gotten together someone from the provost or the chancellor's office, someone who, you know, has access to writing checks, to the deans who are, kind of overseeing the student services and the well-being of their students at various schools, student representatives, healthcare representatives, counseling representatives. So people are sitting around the table and can prioritize, you know, what are the biggest stresses going on our particular university? What are the key issues that we need to deal with and where we need to put our resources? And if you get people from these diverse groups around a table, you can talk about it. I mean, you know, schools can provide as much healthcare as students want. The question is the cost. You know, what's a reasonable amount of healthcare for all students? And if a graduate student needs to be in weekly therapy and there isn't a good insurance benefit and there aren't low-cost referral sources in the community, how much care can you provide? How much psychotherapy can you provide? How much medical care can you provide? If graduate students want to have a family, is there coverage for fertility treatments? So there are lots of, you know, very complicated questions, But I think you need to get all the interested parties around the table to talk and prioritize about these issues.
Actually, my question was different, but thank you for that answer.
Sure.
I was talking about the fact that I was wondering if there was not a similar rise in mental health problems in the whole population, but you're just able to study
them
better.
Yeah, I mean, I think that people are feeling a lot of stress and a lot of pressure. There's so many variables. It's so, you know, it's such a difficult thing to measure in society. I certainly think since 9/11, you know, we're all much more aware that, you know, terror can happen in the United States. Prior to 9/11, you know, terrible things were happening around the world, but I don't think we thought or worried as much about what might happen, you know, right around the corner from us. So that's, you know, playing a role.
Yeah,
sure.
I'm wondering, even, you know, with this talk of Social Security disappearing, students having massive debts, the economy being less, you know, working less efficiently, apparently, or offering fewer possibilities. I'm wondering if these kinds of issues, or, you know, you can talk about terror or the war or other kinds of Bushisms. So I'm just wondering, then, what about general, like, you know, the news, what's going on in the world or in their world in a more political sense? Do you think that's in any way affecting?
Well, I think it's a factor, and I think, you know, the fact that healthcare costs are continuing to rise dramatically, that, you know, the whole advent of managed care has had a huge impact on, you know, people's access to care, how much care they can get, how long they can get care. The, you know, pharmaceutical industry doing public advertising now about, you know, you need this drug or that drug. I think, you know, we're still in terms of, you know, culturally, you know, the eating disorder situation hasn't gotten any worse, but it really hasn't gotten much better either. And, you know, we're still giving, you know, we get bombarded with this message about, you know, needing to be, you know, impossibly thin and, you know, you need to look like the people on TV, and it's just not realistic for 95% of the population.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank the caller for her comments. We're moving into our last 15 minutes, and I have some others I'd like to include, and I should also, again, introduce the guest. Maybe if you just tuned in, we're speaking with Dr. Richard Catterson. He's chief of the Mental Health Service at Harvard University Health Services. He is a board-certified psychiatrist and has specialized throughout his career in campus mental health issues, and is co-author of the book College of the Overwhelmed, The Campus Mental Health Crisis and What to Do About It, a book that just came out last fall in September. So if you're interested in looking at the book, I'm sure you can find it out at the bookstore or perhaps at the library. And on this program, questions are welcome too. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And we go again to another caller. This is Champagne and Line 2.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question about the effects of the antidepressant medication in terms of maniac behavior. How could you discuss a little bit of that?
About manic, about antidepressants and mania?
Is yes. What,
okay. Well, there's it appears that when, you know, first of all, let me say a little bit about, you know, there are many different types of depression. One type of depression is called manic depressive illness, now called bipolar disease, where people have periods where they're depressed, they feel very low, hopeless, low energy, can't get out of bed, and they sometimes slip into what's called mania, which is behavior where people don't sleep, their speech is very rapid, they feel on top of the world, and, you know, literally become psychotic in terms of kind of grandiose thinking and one jumping from one idea to another. So there's some evidence that when one trigger for mania is not getting enough sleep, both depression and bipolar disease, one of the common ages of onset is around during the college years. But sometimes if someone is depressed and maybe has no history of mania, when they go on antidepressant medication, it can pull them out of the depression, but they sort of pass the midway point and go into mania, where they become elated and grandiose and, you know, generally that indicates you need to stop the medication and review things. Sometimes there are other medications called mood stabilizers if someone becomes psychotic that they may need to be on. So there's a risk of, you know, because so many more students are on medication now and starting medication in high school and college, that we may be seeing the emergence of someone who has kind of an underlying tendency to bipolar disorder. You see this first manic episode when they start on antidepressant medication.
And in that case, what is the course of action?
The course of action is to stop the medication. Sometimes that clears the mania up very quickly. Sometimes the person that also needs to go on some kind of mood-stabilizing medication, which is a different class and group of medications that, you know, help the person to not be high and also not hit lows either. But students are much happier when they're, you know, if you've been depressed for a long time and have no energy and suddenly you feel on top of the world and that you can do anything, it's a, you know, it's a pleasant, pleasurable feeling. And a lot of times students are reluctant to take medication to let go of that because they don't see the destructive side of it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Sure.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's go to someone else. This next caller is in Champaign and line one. Hello.
Hello. I was wondering if there was any data concerning the difference between students who come in for help for depression or other disorders and students of faith, either any church organization or any faith for that matter, or if perhaps there is just a general trend among students who have more extramural activities or other activities outside of their academic realms that help them stay healthier.
Yeah,
I think
that's another underutilized resource in college, that there are many excellent chaplains, and some people are, you know, certainly there's less stigma, and some people feel much more comfortable talking to someone of a certain religious faith or background. I think we have, in our United Ministries, I think we have 28 or 38 different religions represented, and I think that's another resource that campuses should make students aware of, and, you know, that can be a support in a similar way, and, you know, there are chaplains who are, you know, trained counselors who can be extremely helpful. Generally, they can't prescribe, so if the problem is to the point where someone has a biologic problem and needs medication, they may need to do some, you know, counseling with their chaplain and see a psychiatrist or nurse or primary care doctor to get medication as well. But that certainly makes a difference. And I think on the extracurricular activity side, extracurricular activities, you know, help create connections and a sense of family for students. That's the good news about them. The bad news about them is that I think people overcommit themselves to too many extracurricular activities, and that's one of the problems, that it's really hard for students to, you know, find a reasonable balance in their lives.
Okay. And again, to another caller, this is someone listening in Terre Haute in Indiana, line number four. Hello.
Hello. Yeah, I think as I was walking from the car to get my phone at home, that he might have answered the question I had in mind, and I didn't hear it all, so I may be repeating something. That was what I wanted to know, is to what extent the Department of Mental Health Services recommended religion. And I have here... just recently purchased a book by Joan Borisenko, The Power of the Mind to Heal. Now, it says she's was from Harvard. She's a psychiatrist from there. And from what little I've read, she makes a great case for the mind and basically religion, although she doesn't necessarily call that into attention. She talks about the importance of prayer and how that can do.
Yeah, I think, you know, different things work for different people. I think people who have a strong spiritual and religious background sometimes find that to be an extremely effective way to address life issues. I think when there are biologic problems involved, you know, medical people need to be involved to deal with those. But I would agree with Dr. Borisenko that I think all kinds of things can be helpful in healing and managing stress, and religious and spiritual ones are extremely important, just as, you know, good diet is and getting enough sleep is.
Well, do you ever recommend to people who, most kids coming to college don't have any religious background. Do you ever recommend to them, or on any kind of list, is how to deal with mental health problems? Try religion, like for example.
Well, I don't think we would refer people based on that if they don't have a background. You know, one of the questions that we routinely ask when students come in is what is their religious or spiritual orientation? If they don't have one, sometimes it can be helpful for them to talk with someone and, you know, learn about different religions and different resources, particularly if, you know, they're dealing with a life crisis like a, you know, family member gets diagnosed with cancer or, you know, there's a critical illness. Those might lead to, you know, referrals to talk with people to get some religious or grief support around that. But if someone doesn't have an orientation, I don't think sending them to find a religion to cure the underlying problem is a direction that we would go.
Well, this book they're talking about lately, The Purpose-Driven Life, does that have any value in...
I think if people are, you know, if people have a focus on altruistic, you know, behaviors that help other people and give one a sense of satisfaction and a sense that you're doing something for your community, that can be extremely helpful. And you know, finding out how to do that and what works for each individual varies a lot, but it certainly can be helpful in having a focus and an area in life where you feel very positively is very helpful. One of the problems is that when people get depressed, they feel unmotivated in all areas, and nothing brings any sense of satisfaction or accomplishment.
Okay, thank you very
much.
All right,
thanks for the call. Again, we'll go to someone here locally in Urbana. This is line number one. Hello.
Hi. I'd like to know, when is it safe to stop to take the medication, or when does a person know that he or she is cured from depression?
Okay. So the question is, when does someone know when they should be on medication, and when do they know when they're cured or when they're...
Yeah, when they know that when they're cured, yes.
Okay. So in terms of when someone should go on medication, there's lots of research going on. Someday I expect there will be some kind of blood test that will tell us, you know, you've got this imbalance, just as there is with diabetes and thyroid disease. You've got this imbalance. This is what you need to correct the imbalance. That's what the medications do. At this point, we largely look at a number of factors like family history of depression, which increases the likelihood that you're going to be depressed. What are called physical or vegetative signs of depression, the most classic ones are sleep disturbances, waking up too early in the morning, having trouble getting to sleep at night, waking up throughout the night, or not being able to get out of bed in the morning. Now, you know, almost every college student has one of those at some time or other, but... As we talked about earlier in the program, when there's a pervasive problem and it's a shift with sleep, changes in appetite, can be increases or decreases in appetite, loss of interest, social withdrawal, that's really a big one that we ask very carefully about with college students. If someone felt engaged with a group of roommates or friends and suddenly they just don't want to be around other people, they've lost their motivation, they're having concentration problems, they're feeling anxious all the time. The glass is always half empty. They're feeling negative about everything that's going on in their life. If they've got a constellation of those symptoms and they've been pretty persistent, then oftentimes those are symptoms that medication would help with. Now, when people go on medication, you know, one of the questions that's always asked is, how long do I need to be on the medication? Medications usually take about 3 to 6 weeks to work for most people. Very often, 60 or 70% of the time, the first medication that someone tries will work. And one of the advantages of these newer medications is many times the dose that you start with is the dose that you end with, so you don't have to be making lots of adjustments of dosage. And generally, we recommend that people stay on medication between 9 months and a year. And people say, why do I have to stay on this medication so long if I'm feeling much better in 3 weeks? And the notion is that the medication is helping your body normalize and create chemical balance with these things called neurotransmitters, largely serotonin and sometimes norepinephrine.
And if you stop in less than 9 months, there's probably about a 50% chance that your symptoms will return. If you wait 9 months to a year, it's only a 10 or 20% chance. If someone's having side effects from the medication, usually they're pretty minimal. But, you know, if someone's having side effects, that's a stronger reason to get off the medication sooner. Medications tend to be pretty expensive. I think only Prozac at this point is available in a generic form. It's called fluoxetine. And the pills all cost, you know, $2 plus a pill. So if you don't have insurance coverage, you know, that's another factor that might, you know, make someone want to get off medication more quickly.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Sure. We are just about at the point that we're going to have to stop. We have talked about the mental health problem on the campus. We've talked about what schools are doing to try to respond. We talked a little bit about the kind of education that they can do or maybe should do with students to tell students how to take better care of themselves. There is a section in the book that's aimed at parents, and maybe we could talk for a minute, because that's about all the time we have.
Okay, sure.
Of what, you know, what you would want to say to parents.
Well, I think the main thing that I want to say to parents is, you know, when kids leave for school, parents often feel like now they're off on their own, they're adults, they don't really need me anymore, and I need to back off. And very often parents get the message from their students, you know, leave me alone, I'm an adult, I'm off at school, don't bug me. And my advice is very important for parents to stay engaged with their students, that the transition to college is a very vulnerable time. In these national surveys, students are asked, if you have a health problem, where you get your information. 70 or 80% of the time, they get it from their parents. Parents, in most cases, are going to be more concerned more invested than their students than anyone else is going to be. And my advice to parents is that they stay in touch with their students. They set up a regular time to have contact just to kind of find out how things are going. And students, you know, will maybe reluctant to tell them about any difficulties. I encourage parents to maybe not share in grim detail, but to let students know that they had difficulties and stresses when they were in college. So the expectation isn't, gee, college is, you know, these are the best years of my life. I'm supposed to be happy all the time. So if I'm not, I shouldn't tell my parents because they'll be disappointed in me. But it's really important to stay engaged with your students. And when they have a problem, not necessarily to jump in and be Mr. or Mrs. Fix-It, but to remember that students need to learn how to solve problems. And it's kind of the message of teach your students how to fish rather than giving them fish.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you very much. Sure. We're going to have to leave it at that. Our guest, Dr. Richard Catterson, he is the chief of the Mental Health Service at Harvard University Health Services. Thanks very much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. Take care.
Focus 580 made possible by grant from Bodywork Associates this year, celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. The broadcast also made possible with support from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, presenting Urbana Uncorked, special wine tasting event to benefit WILL, Saturday, April 2nd from 3 to 7 at the Urbana Civic Center. Dozens of wines, many not readily available in Central Illinois, will be featured. For more tickets, tickets are available at the door. For more information, call 337-7704. That's it for us. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk about global eavesdropping. Our guest will be Patrick Radden Keefe. He joins us at 106 Central Time. He's the author of Chatter, Dispatches from the Secret World.